lot of stores, a lot of the stores depended upon income from outside sales. And they call them concessionaires or vendors.
It's common even today.
It's very common today. I'll show you a letter I got from the McCrory store, where they start the letter with, "Our records show that you have successfully run numerous demonstrations in our store, which have been beneficial to both of us. We are trying to make plans now for our coming summer season." And they send me a list of 500 stores and ask me to make up an itinerary or pick what stores I'd like to work in and make the arrangements. They get a percentage in those stores, and they depend upon it. It makes money for them. Well, stop and think. If you owned, let's say, just a neighborhood grocery store, and somebody came in and says, "Hey, I want to sell chewing gum out of this machine. I want 2 feet of space to put the machine. The chewing gum won't cost you a nickel. I'll service it. I'll put it in, take it out, and when the money comes in, we'll count the money together, and from every dollar, I'll give you a dime." What can you lose? You see? It's the same thing, it's like cigarette vending, all these other machines and things. Well, but the pitchman is a live vendor, and he also brings some excitement to the thing.
So that is still done a lot.
Sure.
Somebody that is a pitchman, how does he find out about these stores?
Well, the stores, of course, they want us. Some stores don't now. For instance, when we first opened a specific foot package in the Kresge store, and this was the alcohol stick, years and years ago, which kept the feet cool and pliable and all that. I flew up to Detroit, which was their number one store of the country, and with two top-notch workers to open that store. We had a $2,000 day. One day. All right? And I am still welcome in all of the Kresge stores and a lot of the Crest stores, but I cannot put a demonstration into Kmart. I have approached the Kmart people, and it's owned by Kresge's. Kresge's the mother company. But Kmart simply does not want a demonstration or a concession that is not a year-round concession. In other words, if I came to Kmart and said, "I want to put a photography department in your store that would sit there all year," this they would consider, because they would prefer to have a concession rather than have their own merchandise tied up. And photography is a very big thing in the Kmart stores. Some are concessions and some are company-owned. but they want year-round. And it's the same thing with Woolco. For years I had a demonstration on the boardwalk in Atlantic City in the Woolworth store. But Woolco doesn't want them. You know, not they don't want temporary concessions. Now McCrory's, they prefer a temporary concession. You know, you come in for 2 or 3 weeks, take the cream off the top, you move out, someone else moves in. Although I had one McCrory store that I held for 2 years, and I simply changed items. But I held the counter there for 2 full years. Just kept changing items.
What are you pitching now? What kinds of things do you...
I'm pitching the pens and the jewelry cleaner. Those are the two items that we're working on.
I saw that being sold at Christmas time at Sears.
The jewelry cleaner? That's a possibility, yeah. Although that might have been another package, I'm not sure. Take a look at it. It says Gem Jewelry Cleaner.
I'm pretty sure it's the same one. Yeah.
Where were you when you saw it?
Albany.
You were in Albany. Oh, yeah. Up there, it's possible. Yeah, because I don't have any stores up that way. She might be selling it to someone else up there. But as I say, it comes from Buffalo. If you look at it, you see it's made in Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. So it comes through Buffalo. And They get it into Buffalo and pay the duty on it, because I have absolutely refused, and I pay the freight from Buffalo to here for the stuff that I want. What was that?
Oh. Hello?
I forgot that one rings that way. I made a tape that you might be interested in hearing. I don't know if you want to record it or reproduce it, but it's a 7-minute tape. And it was made by accident. And it was accident. Back, I don't know, 19, 20, maybe I was 23. I was freelancing. Things were tough. Radio had gone dead. And although I did DJ work and interview shows, etc., I was still grabbing what work I could where I could. And I was narrating various shows for different people. The Mata and Hari Dance Troupe, which was a famous troupe, decided that they're going to present new, I guess you can call them ballets, but they weren't strictly ballet. They were very much modern dance. And they decided they needed a narrator for some of these things. And since I had narrated cantatas, and they called me. And money wasn't big, but I went to Philadelphia, the city of brotherly gunmen, and on a Sunday, and as W.C. Fields said, the city was closed. The only thing open was the Horn and Hardart across the street from the Academy of Music. But this was at the Academy of Music. It was a charity affair, so I wasn't being paid much. I think I got $75 for the day, plus my train fare from New York, and whistle for the cab fare. When I got there, I looked on the front of the thing, and I said, well, at least I'm in very good company. Because not only did they have the Mata and Hari dance troupe, but on the same program they had, what's his name, the conductor? Eugene Ormandy, conducting the Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra, and the 160 voices of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And this was in the days when the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was really the choir of the world. It was the most famous choir. Now I think they're down to about 80 voices, but 160 voices. So I said, wow, you know, pleasure to be on the program, you know. Anyway, I stepped inside, and there was some guy sitting out in the audience with a board writing gain. And the place is such a barn, you know, that they had like 27 mics all over the place. And this guy had to be an octopus. So orchestra was playing, and the choir was on stage. They were rehearsing. And they were doing the Lord's Prayer, and then they went into the Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, and a couple of their other things. Anyway, when they got through, they called for the Mata and Hari dance troupe. I got up. I'd never seen this particular ballet before. They had a script for me, so I had to keep one eye on the script and one eye on the dancers, and I had to learn that at the end of this pas de deux, I talk again. At the end of the beginning of this, or at this musical downbeat. So the orchestra's learning the music, because they'd never rehearsed with them before, and I'm learning this. And finally, we go through a rehearsal, and we decide, okay, we'll make it. We'll get through it. And at the end of the thing, Ormandy puts down his baton and walks over to me. And like I said, I was just a punk kid, you know. And he says, young man, you have the most beautiful voice I have ever heard. Are you an actor? And I said, yes, sir. And the musical director comes running up. He says, my God, what a voice. Can you sing? And I said, not a note. And the guy from the back is riding, he comes down, he says, man, he says, you got to be a pro. He says, from the time, he says, I got a level on you, I never had to touch the mic. He says, you moved in, you moved out. He says, never had to touch the game. So, and he had a strange machine with him, something I had not seen, and I'd been doing radio. But in those days in radio, we, for recording, were using wire. which got all tangled up, and then it was a mess. And he had a machine that he rolled a paper tape onto, and it was a tape recorder, but it had paper backing. They hadn't even found polyester yet. And Ormandy said, well, why don't you do something dramatic? And the musical director says, yeah, maybe we can give you background. And this guy says, I'll tape it. And I'm saying, well, what can I do? What can I do? Yeah. At that point, I'd been doing gangster roles. wouldn't lend itself. But about 2 years before, I had done a Theater Guild of the Air. Or a U.S. Steel. I don't remember what it was. I think it was U.S. Steel presents the Theater Guild of the Air. And I had played the part of Philip Nolan, the man without a country. And I never memorized the script because, you know, radio. But enough of it had stuck with me that I'm running it over my mind. I said, maybe I'll do scenes from The Man Without a Country. In other words, I'll jump from the beginning to where he dies at the end. Actually, he died as a young man. And but I was going to give him some age. Ormandy says, fine. And he puts on a pair of earphones so that he can hear the orchestra over me or hear me over the orchestra. And there wasn't time for rehearsal. It was like 20 after 1. The house opened at 2, and performance was 2:30. So we had to get out of the house, you know, so they can open the house at 2. And Ormandy said, what do you want for background? I don't remember. I think they had just come out with, what's the name of it? God, it was so popular at that time. It was The Rage. It was it was from a movie with Boye and the Swedish... No. Always before that, Ingrid Bergman and it was a marvelous love song, you know, a great. And I said, well, so I said, and he
when
looked at me.
No,
before that. I'll play it for you. You'll hear it. You may recognize the song, the opening number. Anyway, for an opening, you know, what do you want? And I said, he turns to them. And he says, gentlemen, and they said, we'll fake it. You know, 100 of the best musicians in the world. You know, and I said to the choral director, somewhere in here, I will say the words, "Will you pray with me?" When I do, come in with the Lord's Prayer. And then at the end, when I'm dying, sneak in with the glory, glory, hallelujah, build it to a crescendo, and I'll ad lib until, you know, it works out right. but I'm listening to them, and you know, and it was a talk through rehearsal, you see, and this guy taped it. I have the tape. I thought it was terrible. I was sure it was awful. When I played it, it wasn't really that bad. Actually, what's really bad is the fact that I got hammy. I overacted. I was so impressed with the fact that I had two magnificent groups with me. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra. You know, I was in awe of them, and not only that, of course, I was fighting for words, and I was listening for transitions in the music, you see, because like I said, well, when I'm at sea, do something tinkly, you know, they did a fabulous job. They really did. If you'd like to hear it, I'll play it for you. All right.
Yeah.
Huh?
No, really. I have a couple of questions though. First,
all right.
You've talked about a couple of different styles of pitching with the auction is a different kind
mm-hmm.
of pitch than the pen pitch and candy pitch. When you're pitching, say, for a girly show or say at a carnival or a circus where you
right.
need people to come in, I was curious, do you ever pitch where you would rhyme your speech at all?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I write. You see, right now, part of my business that I do, I write the pitch for the particular person I'm making the tape for. And not only do I write it, but I do the tape. Now, I had one guy who had a shooting gallery, an electronic shooting gallery, and he was looking for a tape to stop them. I also made his other tapes that play. There we had a lot of work because you had to put the little metallic tabs on them so that they only go so far and stop. You see, and then they start again with a micro switch when the thing gets hit with the gun. But I made him a rhyming tape to stop people and get them to play his game. I may even have it written out somewhere here because I saved the writing, the and of course I have a master of everything.
So in other words, they're not actually talking; they're playing your tape.
They're playing my tape. Yeah. Oh no, some of them are doing live ballets. But you see, if it's slow, sometimes they don't want to put a man out there to blow his pipes. To do a live ballet where the tape will explain rather well what's going on inside. But now I've even begun to make tapes for games, you see. And,
What kind of
games? Oh, for a bottle up, for
carnival
a...
Games.
Carnival games. And it frees a person, it gets them off the microphone, and it frees them to go out and make change and do things. The people who use my tapes have come back for more and have told me that I have saved them money. I've made them money. And when I make them a tape, especially for a show, like I made Ward's, I made a tape for his baby show, which he no longer has. I think he sold that that show. Yeah, for the Pickle Punks. I made him a tape for his two-head. And Ward is very capable of making beautiful tapes himself. I mean, he's, you know, he takes a back seat to no one. but with these things, I guarantee the tape in that if you're familiar with what your show is doing and you don't feel it is taking every possible dime for you. In other words, I tell them, watch the people. If it stops them, they listen for a moment and then walk away, then I'm doing something wrong. Tell me where we lose them. We'll redo the darn thing until it reaches the point where they are motivated to go over to your box office and spend the money. Now, of course, sometimes if a guy has a dummy-looking show and didn't spend anything on a decent front, because that's what you're selling. You're selling the front. The front has to look magnificent. But even with not the greatest looking front, if you've got a good tape, it will do something for you. If you've got a fantastic front and it doesn't stop them, if they just stop and look and there's no real motivation to walk in, as gorgeous as it looks, you ain't going to make any money. So,
Now that kind of pitch, you said, mentioned the word ballet, is that kind of pitch to get people inside?
Yeah, ballet, to ballet means to ballyhoo. That's what the ballet is short for, ballyhoo, and ballyhoo means to call them over, bring them together, build a tip, gather a crowd is building a tip, and there's a difference between a tip and a crowd. Now any damn fool can get a crowd. You see, I can get up on a platform and hold you by the hair and let you struggle to get away. We'll gather a crowd, you know. But to weed out that crowd, to get the potential buyers down front, to get the kids to the back, to bring your money people down, to bring down someone who's going to say, yeah, me, I'll go, and walk up to that box office so that he's a natural stick, that takes a little experience.
See?
And that's called building a tip. One of the difficulties that Joel is having at the moment is that he's worked so hard on learning the pitch and on presenting the pitch that he hasn't really spent too much time on the ballet. I've told him that what he can do is read the ballet just the way I do it, but he still has to do some actions with it. You must put the sets up on the counter. You see, there are places where sometimes traffic is slow. You get four people in front of you, Now you want to hold these four people until some more people walk by, and maybe you can pull them over too. Now, if you're going to still stand there and say the same thing over and over again, these four people are going to get bored, and they're going to walk. So what you do is you must acknowledge the presence of the four people. You must give them a reason to stay there, you see, and then you must get them on your side to help you gather a few more people.
What other kinds of devices do you said you use rhyme or something like that in a valley. What other kinds of devices, like style devices, do you use?
Magic.
Yeah, magic will build a valley. That's right, Joel.
When I was with a 10-in-1, I came out with a big boa constrictor.
I was going to say, snakes are very, very good for gathering a crowd. But again, you see, you gather the crowd, and then you have to do a little bit of a pitch, a little bit of that. And while you're doing that, you're weeding these people out. You're moving this one down here, that one over here. Now, move in closer, brother. I want you to see this. You give them a reason to move in. If you just tell them, now, everybody, come on in close, they're going to take two steps back. And at one point in my period, I say, hey, now, everybody, wiggle in closer, focus your attention right up here. And I don't watch for them to wiggle in closer. If I stand there and wait for them to move in, they ain't going to move in. But I focus my attention up here, and they focus theirs. I put their attention where I want their attention.
What kind of eye contact, then, do you use? Like you were saying, when you'd say, look at this, your eyes are on that. You're not looking at them, which I guess would be more intimidating.
All right. Here, focus your attention right up here. You simply tilt the pen forward, and the point will appear. You tilt it back, and it disappears. Now, I've told them what to look for in front so that when they see it happen, it's a, it's like a magician. Magician doesn't say, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of a hat, and he's got the rabbit. The magician says, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of this hat. And then it's an, It's the same thing with this. You tell them what you're going to do. Tell them what to look for. You see, down to right, up to retract. Now, of course, I know what you're thinking. You're saying to yourself, what happens when you right foot the darn thing? The point stays down. It locks in place. And I write. It will write smoothly and evenly at all times. And they're hypnotized. Absolutely hypnotized. And I do make eye contact, very strong eye contact with them. That's one of the reasons why I refuse to wear sunglasses when I'm working. I try to get a spot where I don't have to wear a sunglass. I will go so far as to wear a thing with a brim coming out, you know, a cap. But I never wear sunglasses.
No, sunglasses.
Let them see your eyes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
When you were saying that, okay, Jack Firestone was kind of a recognized...
He was one of the top experts on foot pitching. Henry Summers was pretty good. He's dead now. I think Jack might be dead too.
What did Henry Summers pitch?
Henry Summers pitched mostly football, more than anything else. Henry Summers was a true enigma. He was a man who stuttered. Who, I mean, stuttered. But once he got into the pitch of what he was saying, I never heard that man stutter. And when he sang magnificently without a stutter and had a gorgeous voice, like Mel Tillis, with no stutter whatsoever. But Henry had a terrible affliction. He had an eye that looked this way and another one that looked that way, and he meant over here. So his eye contact was a little bit difficult, you know. But he would do things like, here, lady, look me in the good eye. Tell me you mean it. You know? which of course would break me up, you know. The man was very funny, he really was. And with Henry, you never knew what he was going to say. In his later years, he had gotten cancer, and when I brought him back from the hospital, he had lost a piece of his tongue, and he had lost all through here. So, and yet he had to work, he had nothing. So we gave him a job as a giver of tickets on the boardwalk to get people to walk into the auction. Here was a man who knew how to spot a potential customer. Ordinarily, I would say the word mark, but I don't mean a mark in the sense that, you know, that they're going to be taken, but someone who would be good for us. This is what you're looking for. You didn't want to fill the thing up with kids. You didn't want to fill it up with people who wanted to get off their feet, because this was a sit-down auction, you see. So you wanted potential. Well, Henry could spot it half a block away, and he was marvelous about lugging. Lugging means bringing them in off the boardwalk and getting them seated. He would give them a ticket. He would tell them about the door prize. And because we did have door prizes, so he would tell them about the door prize, and he would bring them in, and when I was working, Henry would always say, please, good doctor, these people are from Indiana, see to it that you treat them properly, you see. So I knew that he was bringing these people in, you see. Now, later on, at the end of the thing, those people spent $400 with me, and I'm making 15%. naturally, I'm going to slip my $10 bill just for bringing that couple in, you see. It was to my advantage, although he got a salary, but he was out on the boardwalk, and he's lugging. Now, it gets hot out there in the summertime, and sometimes it gets so hot that, especially in a beach resort, people are on the beach. So we're out there, we're trying to build a tip. I'm ringing the bell. I'm trying to get people. I grabbed some kid who was walking by, tied a bandana around his head. I'm putting dollar bills in the bandana, and I'm telling them how I'm going to change the 10 ones into 10 100s. this whole big thing, you know. and finally, We gave up. We just couldn't get anybody. So out of kicks, and just because the boss didn't do any of this kind of work. He just counted money. You see? And if we didn't have a crowd in the room, you'd hear the door slamming, you see. So the boss, to keep the boss happy that there was something going on, I decided, well, I'm going to do a man-in-the-street type interview show, you know. And here, bring that pigeon over. I had no one else to interview. You know, and then some kid was passing by. I said, come here, kid, before men in the white coats come and take me away for talking to myself. And what do you do for a living? And the kid says, I'm in school. I said, well, are you married or are you happy? You know. And then I went to Henry, and I said, and what are you? Here's a likely-looking gentleman. What do you do for a living, sir? And he said, and he broke me up. The way he said, he's me? I'm a pink ticket giver. And of course, I flipped out. And I doubled up with laughter. I lay down on the boardwalk, and when I got up, there were 30 people there. So now I gathered them together and brought them into the auction. I mean, it's real crazy. You know? It's just wild.
I was just wondering, too, with some of the pitchmen that you've learn from, were they ever pitchmen on, say, a medicine show or one of those old traveling shows?
Yeah, I guess they were. There was a pitchman, a fellow named Murray Homelin, and Murray used to travel with a medicine show, and he would gather a crowd by doing the most phenomenal mathematical things I've ever seen in my life. He worked with a huge blackboard that they built onto a platform. And as fast as you could call out figures, he'd have them up there multiplying, dividing, square root. You called it, he did it. That man was a human computer. I don't know how he did it, but he did it. And he was fantastic. Sometimes they'd work on it all through the pitch to come out, by God, he's right. You know? By that time, he's taking the money already. But he sold things to keep your movement natural. And, well, there's a need for those things, you see. You're just young kids. Wait till you get older. I didn't mean that as an insult, by the way.
Did you ever work or hear Doc Bartok? Was he?
I know him. He did a film. He did a thing that they did on public broadcasting. He did a show, which was not truly representative.
Wait, this was the thing that the Smithsonian did?
I think, I'm not sure if the Smithsonian did that one or not.
North Carolina?
Huh?
Was it filmed up in North Carolina?
It may have been. I'm not even sure where it was done or where it was filmed. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it was truly representative
of what the medicine show
was, yeah. And of course, I came along really after that era.
Oh, yeah.
I familiarized myself with it because, to me, it's interesting to delve into the background of what I'm involved in so that I know a great deal about it. I like to study it.
Yeah, I don't know, I guess I think of it as a continuum, really. Maybe the styles change a little bit and the product has changed, but there are certain things that...
Yeah, the products change, but the psychology doesn't. You sell things in a number of ways. Scareology, which is health medicines, greed and larceny, and sometimes religious faith. I do not resort to religious faith in my selling. I will use some degree of scareology. You're going to be left out. Here, come on, send up a buck. You'll be sorry if you don't. Couldn't spend it with a nicer guy anyway. Ask my wife. I get the money out of them, and I have fun doing it. I really do, because when I'm up there, I'm doing a performance, and if I do a good enough performance, they'll throw the money at me.
You've been in all kinds of performing, which kind?